investing in our growing understanding of young minds and how to reach their bright futures. My aim in the time I have with you is to shed some light on how the warm hearts part of our everybody's experience contributes to our bright future, especially for our youth. Now, I've spent about 20 years investigating positive emotions, and I've come to the belief that love is our most misunderstood but also most powerful positive emotion. And just spending time speaking of love from a scientific perspective is challenging because everybody's got their own definition of love, their own deeply personal views on love. And what I'm going to ask for you in the next 25 minutes or so is to just set those aside for a moment to take in a different perspective on love. And what I want to illuminate for you is your body's perspective on love, how love, micro moments of love, nourish us, resonate within us in ways that help us become better versions of ourselves, wiser, healthier, stronger. Before I speak in particular about love, I want to share with you some of the things that the science of positive emotions has found to be true of all positive emotions, and then I'll get more specific about love in particular. One thing that's true of positive emotions in general is that they broaden our awareness. So, you know, if you imagine yourself as this water lily, your face is inside those petals that are wrapped around your face really closely. If you can see anything at all from that vantage point, it's just really what's squarely in front of you. But things change as the sun rises if you're this water lily and your petals pull away from your face. And your worldview, your perspective literally expands. And we know this is not just a flowery metaphor about positive emotions, that even very mild and subtle positive states fundamentally change the way the brain works and increases the breadth of your field of view. So we know that from studies that use eye tracking devices to track the position of the eye 60 times a second, that when people experience even mild positive emotions, they look around and take in more information, whereas typically in a neutral state, we pretty much just look at what's right in front of us. Brain imaging studies also show the same things, that when we're under the influence of positive emotions, we can't help but take in more of the contextual surrounding information. This means that when we're experiencing the uplift of positive emotions, we see more possibilities. Another thing that happens with all positive emotions is they kind of break us out of our cocoon of self-absorption, and we notice there are other people around, and we pay attention to other people and their perspectives. We are more likely to think in terms of inclusive perspectives, like thinking in terms of we than in terms of me versus you. It's just a mode of thinking that comes more naturally when people are feeling mild positive emotions. People are also better at taking another person's perspective. Just with a more uplifted mood or joyful sense, people are more able to take another person's perspective. One thing that is crucially important too with this perspective taking is that things that tend to divide us, like race and cultural differences, when people are feeling the warmth of positive emotions, those divisions slip out of view, and people are more able to recognize individuals across racial and cultural boundaries and make connections because of that. So those are things that are true of all positive emotions. So what is special about love? And so any positive emotion includes this broader awareness, this greater likelihood of seeing another person's perspective. Love is even more than that. What I want to start with, though, in order to clear the ground for giving you a new scientific perspective on the emotion of love, is to just say what I think love is not. And these are a number of things that we often believe to be true of love. Love is not sexual desire. That's something else. Love is not a special bond. Okay, it's a special bond can result from love, but it's not the same thing. Love is not commitment. These are things that may eventually evolve from love, but it's not defined as the same thing as love. Here's a more challenging one for people. Love is not exclusive. Love is not lasting. In fact, I think we need to understand love from the perspective of micro moments. And perhaps challenging for a number of people, love is not unconditional. Love has conditions that need to be met for it to be experienced. So, just for emphasis, for the next few moments, just set aside those views of love that have those pieces. And taking this different perspective on love, again, this comes from the science of emotions, from the science of evolutionary psychology. I think of it as your body's perspective on what's most important about positive emotions and love. I think of love as an interpersonally situated experience marked by momentary increases in three things. I think so often we think of love as a relationship, and I think it's, from an emotions perspective, it's much more useful to think of love as a moment, as a micro moment even. A micro moment where there's shared positive emotions between you and another person. A micro moment when there's a biobehavioral synchrony going on between you and another person. And also a stance of mutual care. It has sort of a moral direction in it, in that you have care and concern for the other. When these three things have risen up together like a wave, that's a momentary experience of love. And over time, the accumulation of micro moments like this, where we share positive emotions, share biobehavioral synchrony and mutual care, those moments add up and build sort of an embodied sense of rapport with others, where you feel like, we really clicked, we really connected. Over time, those micro moments build social bonds, and over time, those micro moments can build a sense of loyalty or commitment. Again, sometimes we think of these other three pieces as synonymous with love, but I think they're the products of love. Any positive emotion, when shared, is instantly transformed into an experience of love. So there's positive emotions range from jump for joy moments, joy, gratitude, serenity, interest, hope, pride, amusement, inspiration, and awe. Those are a wide variety of different positive emotions. Anytime any of those different positive emotions are experienced in a micro moment of connection with another person, they're instantly transformed into a moment of love. Love is any shared positive emotion. I just want to read this for just 1 second, bear with me. Love is experienced in the context of a safe interpersonal connection, a close relationship. For example, in the early stages of a relationship tied up with initial attraction, people are deeply interested in anything and everything this new person says or does. They share amusements and laugh together, often as a result of the awkwardness of coming together for the first time. As a relationship builds and perhaps surpasses their expectations, it brings great joy, and people begin to share their hopes and dreams for their future together. As the relationship becomes more solid, they may sink back into the cozy serenity that comes with the security of mutual love. And at this stage, people in loving relationships often feel grateful for the joys their beloved brings into their life, as proud of their achievements as they are of their own, inspired by their good qualities, and perhaps in awe of the forces of the universe that bring them together. So love is sometimes missed in this idea that any positive emotions that we share in relationship with another creates this micro moment of love. So love can be shared positivity, and it's those shared micro moments of biobehavioral synchrony and mutual care. Now, love's first precondition, there's two preconditions for experiencing these micro moments of love. This is what makes this view of love not unconditional. The first condition is safety. People don't feel these connections with others if they don't feel safe. The second precondition is actually more important, is connection. And what I mean by connection is a real physical connection, whether it's through co-presence, through eye contact, through touch, could also be through human voice, perhaps over the phone. But some kind of physical, real-time connection is a prerequisite for love, for these micro moments of love. And I want to share with you why. One thing that researchers have found is more than any other facial expression, smiles draw our attention, they grab our attention. So we want to make eye contact with somebody who smiles. And that's a really useful thing, because smiles come in so many different forms. People could smile at you for hundreds of different reasons. They could be trying to sell you something, they could be trying to manipulate you, they could be saying, hey, let's make a connection, I'd like to get to know you. So there's lots of different kinds of smiles. How do we know what each smile means? We know because when we make eye contact with somebody who's smiling, we at some level start to mimic their facial expression. This is not something that happens consciously, but when you make eye contact with someone who's making a particular facial expression, our own bodies start to mirror that facial expression. And that mirroring, that mimicry, is exceptionally important because that creates a moment of intersubjectivity where once you mimic somebody else's smile, your body and brain know at one level, that sort of gut sense, what it meant to smile like that. And so your gut then can inform you about whether that was a sincere smile, an insincere smile, a manipulative smile. So your gut begins to inform you, give you an intuition of what that other person meant. That doesn't happen when people don't make eye contact. Without eye contact, you don't have the biobehavioral synchrony to inform your intuitions. These micro moments of love, there's also this biobehavioral synchrony that's sort of acting as one. Sort of two people start to mirror each other's gestures. And that mirroring of gestures is not just an outward appearance, it's also happening at an inner level. But one of the studies that one of my students in my lab has recently conducted, where we had people strangers get to know one another in a laboratory setting, and we videotaped them and asked them later how well they clicked, how well they connected. And above and beyond the positive emotions they shared, the extent of time that they showed this behavioral synchrony in their nonverbal actions predicted their sense of connection, of embodied rapport. And there's other research to show that when parents, both fathers and their mothers, show this sort of positive connection and nonverbal synchrony with their child, that during those moments they also show oxytocin synchrony. Okay, that they're the child and the parents, oxytocin rises and falls in synchrony with one another. There's some other fascinating work to suggest that when people are really connecting, really understanding each other and following each other's words, that there's a kind of a whole brain synchrony going on between the speaker and the listener. Okay, that so when you're really connecting and listening to someone's story, your brains are doing a sort of a parallel dance. It's not that the person speaking has one pattern of brain activity and the person listening has another one. It's like the conversation is one pattern being carried out across two brains. So I think this metaphor, if those of you who remember Dr. Spock, know that he had this technique of a mind meld where he could just put his hand on anybody's head and just know exactly what they were thinking. Well, I would say that Spock had different abilities than us humans, in that for humans to have this sense of a miniature mind meld. We need to be feeling a positive emotion and making eye contact. And Spock's not doing either of those. He's famously unemotional and he's making no eye contact. So for us to get to these mini mind meld states, there needs to be more of this positivity resonance where you're making face, you have eye to eye contact, your bodies and brains are sort of doing a mirror dance with one another. Okay, and at that point, you can even question whether, you know, is this one person's experience of love, or is this one love experienced by two people at the same time, two bodies and brains experiencing the same state. So, these moments of positivity resonance, when positivity resonates between two people, and it can actually happen in larger groups too, but I'm using a dyad or a pair of people just as a simplest example here. But when an emotional state kind of jumps the gap between one person and another, and it becomes shared and reverberates and resonates between people, that's an especially powerful psychological and physical moment for people. And it makes me ask the question of whether love is the supreme emotion. Is this shared positivity, the positivity that we can share with others, is that somehow more nourishing than any other positive emotion is? Is it more potent than individually experienced positivity? And I think it is. And here's some of our evidence for this, is that we do studies in my research laboratory where we randomly assign people to spend a season of their life learning a new technique to self-generate the experiences of love more frequently through meditation. We use loving kindness meditation for this. By random assignment, people either learn this or this technique, or they just simply provide us with all the measures while they're waiting to learn this in the next season. And when people learn this technique for self-generating more experiences of positivity, resonance, and love, their positive emotions increase over time, their feelings of connection with others increase over time, and those increases change who they are fundamentally. It builds their mindfulness, their ability to stay focused in the present moment. It leaves them feeling like they have warmer, more trusting relationships with others. It gives them a better ability to cope with adversity and manage difficult changing circumstances in daily life. People even report having fewer aches, pains, colds, and flus. This health link is something that we've been especially interested in, and that has brought us to look particularly at the link between people's feelings of warm and trusting social connection with others and their physical health. And in doing that, we've zeroed in on the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is your 10th cranial nerve, which emerges from your brainstem and connects your brain to your heart. It also makes other stops along the way in your body. And the vagus nerve is part of your parasympathetic nervous system, which is like the calm and connect aspect of your autonomic nervous system, in contrast to the sympathetic nervous system, which is kind of your fight or flight part of your autonomic nervous system. And it calms down humans' naturally high heart rates. In particular, we can measure the strength of people's vagus nerve, or the health of their vagus nerve, by measuring what's called vagal tone. Vagal tone is the very subtle arrhythmia that occurs with each breath you take. So it's marked by a pattern of a higher heart rate while you're breathing in, because your higher heart rate there can just take that new freshly oxygenated blood and send it throughout your body. But your vagus nerve is responsible for slowing your heart rate down while you're exhaling, because at that moment there's not any freshly oxygenated blood to quickly diffuse. So that subtle arrhythmia in heart rate is a marker of the strength or health of your vagus nerve. And the vagal tone is very interesting because it's viewed as like a vital sign that predicts people's health. It is related to better cardiovascular regulation, better glucose regulation. At a psychological level, it's related to people's better ability to regulate their attention and regulate their emotions, and then have better social skill, actually. So what's interesting about vagal tone is that many scientists view it as a very stable attribute of a person. It's sort of like your adult height. It's generally quite stable. What we found, though, is that as people learn this technique, loving-kindness meditation, they are actually showing improvements over time in their vagal tone. So for some scientists, hearing that, it's like saying we've made people taller. It's not something that is viewed as something likely to change. But we find that 3 months later, after people have learned this technique for self-generating more experiences of love, they end up with higher levels of vagal tone, which contributes to higher social skills, higher better health, and more connection. And we find that that is especially the active ingredient that accounts for the change that occurs in the people who practice this loving kindness meditation. It's not just a change in the breathing patterns or a change in to doing something for yourself. It's that those positive, warm moments of connection, of positivity, resonance, of love that people feel with others is the what we've identified statistically to be the active ingredient that accounts for that shift in health. And we also find that there's upward spirals, that there's reciprocal relationships between this vagal tone and these moments of love or positivity resonance between people, where people with higher vagal tone are more likely to be the ones who in daily life report the most moments of positive connection or positivity resonance or love, these micro moments of love in daily life. But the more people have these moments of love in daily life, the higher their vagal tone becomes over time. So there's a way in which these micro moments of positive connection are literally building a pathway towards health. Right now, we're just embarking on a study where we will randomly assign people to learn this love-rich form of meditation, loving-kindness meditation, or a different form of meditation that is less focused on this emotion, or be in a weightless control group. And we take blood samples before and after, and then a long-term follow-up to see how this new ability to self-generate love is potentially affecting how gene expression unfolds, especially in the immune system that regulates inflammation and health. So literally we'll be able to look at whether the ability to self-generate these micro moments of love more frequently affects us at a cellular level, changing our prospects for health and disease. Now, arguably, what we're finding here is that the body can be in either one of two modes physiologically. Now, we can be in a kind of self-survival mode, kind of eat or be eaten, or we could be in a species survival mode where we're trying to connect and build and preserve our relationships and our community and our culture. And these moments of love as positivity resonance are the building blocks for being in this species survival mode. You know, obviously we need the self-survival mode when we're facing dangers, but I think we're losing sight of how to get into these other modes that will really replenish us as a community. So this new perspective on love as these micro moments of shared positivity, biobehavioral synchrony, and mutual care really opens up possibilities. I think we're all very used to thinking of love between, you know, your soulmate or your romantic partner. But we also, I think, need to open our eyes to see moments of two people just getting to know one another for the first time. You know, these are a pair of young college students who showed up in our lab. They probably would really not like me calling what they experienced love. But those micro moments of connection are what our bodies thirst for to become healthier and become on a trajectory of growth. And so whether we choose to call it love or not, this can be a matter of personal preference. But the reason I think that it's worthy of calling it love is because we need to elevate those moments as being more important than other moments, those moments that we connect with others. So implications for youth, parents, and teachers. I think that essential for the health and growth of young minds is real face time, actual face-to-face time, eye contact, genuine smiles. Okay, and that raises this question of what's a smile for? What is a genuine, authentic smile for? I think we're often really confused about what is the meaning of a smile. Now, early scientific accounts, you know, use the idea that, well, this is a facial expression. It expresses what I feel, what the smiling person feels. Other takes on it say, actually, what a smile is for evoking positive emotion in another person. A smile is a way to induce a positive emotion, not just express one. And other scholars have said, well, you know, a smile can evoke the sense of you know a little bit more about what the other person feels, that mind meld moment. And still other scholars have said, well, you know, that joint expression of positivity can be a way to broaden our collective mindsets and build our collective resources. And to that I say, you know, it's all of these. But maybe another way to look at smiles is that they're a smile, a genuine smile that we offer to another is a way to create this life-giving nutrient, this micro-moment of positivity resonance that not only contributes to your own health, but to the other person's health. So you're both giving and receiving health with that smile. So, I think of love, these micro moments of positivity resonance as the seed that forges the bond, that weaves the social fabric, and promotes our health, and also promotes our growth, our psychological growth and our spiritual growth. And I think of it as the supreme emotion, or the pinnacle emotion. Now, the only thing that was wrong with this picture that I found for supreme was that there was only one person in it. So I got the two in here, mimicking each other's pace. And we have this phrase in, you know, that we say, well, something is made with love. And I actually think when you could think of human, the human species as made with love, of course, but you can also think of us as made for love. And with that, I would love to thank you for your kind attention and wish you the best for the rest of this meeting. Thanks.
To summarize extremely quickly in two sound bites, what she said is, love, this way of looking at love is any time you and another person share a positive feeling, biobehavioral synchrony means you're doing the same thing and you care for the other person. That's a moment of love. And so moments of love are available throughout your life, if you look at it that way. And physiologically, that's what love is, and it brings the psychological and physical benefit. In terms of the physical benefit, a moment like that causes causes you to sigh in relief. It causes your heart rate to, you know, to, this is the vagal tone stuff, it causes you to become to breathe out, to become parasympathetic. So those moments of releasing tension that we walk around with in the moment of connection with another person, those are the life-giving moments because you're releasing that tension which is not good for you physically. When you're with another person in a moment like that, there's a release that happens. That's what the vagal tone stuff is what she said. So I think this was a pretty interesting take on love and on where positive psychology is going, which is into physiology, like everything else. But I thought I would just mention it to you because a lot of people think love is this kind of great big thing that you can't find, as opposed to you can find this in a moment on the line at Ralph's. True. When you look at another person in the eye and you smile at one another and you say, how's your day going? And the two of you are in biobehavioral synchrony, caring for one another and sharing a moment of warmth. And that's a moment that is mentally and physically as potent as any moment gets. Right, so we are adjourned. More than adjourned, I will see you next week.